The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
So for those of you who don't know, Mark is away on a retreat, and he'll be leading a retreat for a month or so. So there'll be several guest teachers filling in for him, several great community members. So I'm looking forward to that. And I'm really happy to help. And today I'll be sharing some thoughts on this teaching of the preciousness of human life. I'll start with this sutta, this discourse. So the Buddha says, "Monks, suppose that this great earth were totally covered with water, and a man were to toss a yoke with a single hole there. A wind from the east would push it west, a wind from the west would push it east, a wind from the north would push it south, a wind from the south would push it north. And suppose a blind sea turtle were there. It would come to the surface once every 100 years. Now, what do you think? Would that blind sea turtle, coming to the surface once every 100 years, stick his neck into the yoke with a single hole?" And the monk said, "It would be a sheer coincidence, Lord, that the blind sea turtle, coming to the surface once every 100 years, would stick his neck into the yoke with a single hole." And the Buddha says, "It's likewise a sheer coincidence that one obtains the human state. It's likewise a sheer coincidence that a Tathagata," which is what he referred to himself as, "worthy and rightly self-awakened, arises in the world. It's likewise a sheer coincidence that a doctrine and discipline expounded by a Tathagata appears in the world. Now, this human state has been obtained. A Tathagata worthy and rightly self-awakened has arisen in the world. A doctrine and discipline expounded by a Tathagata appears in the world. Therefore, your duty is the contemplation. This is stress. This is the origination of stress. This is the cessation of stress. Your duty is the contemplation. This is the path of practice leading to the cessation of stress." Those last are the Four Noble Truths, which probably a lot of you recognize. So that's the sort of cosmological view that comes to us from the tradition, from the Buddhist tradition, not just in Theravada Buddhism, but in the other later traditions as well. So I think it's interesting to reflect on our first reactions maybe to hearing a teaching like that. And I'll speak a bit more about this quality of samvega. It's the Pali word, and it's translated as spiritual urgency often. And that's sort of the feeling that passage can bring up, especially the end. Therefore, it's so rare. So he's kind of saying, so make use of it. And so I think it's interesting just throughout our conversation today to reflect on what that brings up in us, because it can also bring up a feeling of pressure, or just disbelief, not wanting, but you know, even we don't have to believe this cosmological teaching to recognize that life is fleeting, that it's precious, what we do is important. Some other reasons that the human life is considered precious, because it's rare, as that passage described. And also because it's kind of in the middle. If you look at the Buddhist cosmological realms, there's the what are called the hell realms, where beings are suffering a lot. There's the icy hell realm, the hot hell realm, the pokey hell realm, I think. So it doesn't sound very nice, and it doesn't sound like it would be very easy to meditate in that condition. And then the animal realm is a bit higher up, but still they don't have the intelligence, it's said, to practice in the same way that we can. But in our realm, and then there's the heavenly realms where beings have very long lives, their bodies aren't gross like ours, they're sort of celestial, they don't have aches and pains, and so we're in the middle, because something I read when looking at things for this talk was all states of consciousness are available in the human realm, and I thought that was really interesting. We've all experienced hell realms and heavenly realms, and that motivates us as we're not so hopefully, and this is part of practice too, is to cultivate tranquility, cultivate stability, not just through meditation but through how we live our lives, and the cultivating generosity and ethical conduct, so that we can more easily feel safe, feel comfortable. So hopefully, with that, with practice, but also just that we have enough comfort, and especially those of us here in this room probably are also especially privileged to have time, to have the energy, the interest to practice. So again, another, this is from Tanisro Bhikkhu, who's a monk and a scholar, about Samvega, spiritual urgency. Samvega was what the young Prince Siddhartha, which was the Buddha before he was the Buddha, Samvega was what the young Prince Siddhartha felt on his first exposure to aging, illness, and death. For those of you who don't know the story, it's the myth of the Buddha as a young prince having a lot of comfort. And according to the story, he'd never really come to terms with the fact that he would grow old and die. And so in the story, his charioteer takes him around and he sees... Sure. You want to show me where? Or you can just do it. Is it staying? Okay, thanks, Caleb. So the charioteer, so he sees an aging person, a sick person, and a dead person, and it shocks him. And he also sees a renunciate, someone wearing robes and looking for a happiness that's not disturbed by these truths of aging, sickness, and death. So that's the story. So here's what Tanisro Bhikkhu says. Samvega was what the young Prince Siddhartha felt on his first exposure to aging, illness, and death. It's a hard word to translate because it covers such a complex range, at least three clusters of feelings at once. The oppressive sense of shock, dismay, and alienation that come with realizing the futility and meaninglessness of life as it's normally lived, a chastening sense of our own complacency and foolishness in having let ourselves live so blindly, and an anxious sense of urgency in trying to find a way out of the meaningless cycle. One quote from that, I don't know exactly where it comes from, but that the Buddha said, at that moment, the vanity of youth left me. And I like that. But again, I think it's good to just see how these teachings, reflections land, because they're really counter to a lot of our conditioning, you know, to look at I look at these truths, and I think it's important how we look at them. And so then to just reflect, how do we receive it? Does it inspire us? Is it kind of oppressive, depressing? But I think it can, it can be used as medicine to reflect on our lives. What do we really value? What are we cultivating day by day, moment by moment? I'd like to share a poem by Mary Oliver, The Summer Day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean, the one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I've been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? I think it's interesting how rare I am really present. And attending in this way that life, not life conceptually, but life, this is precious. I think it takes confidence, it takes practice to trust that this moment is worthy of opening to. And I like this framework of life as precious in terms of our actual moment-to-moment practice. And not so much that we have to think and reflect, you know, this is a precious moment because I'm alive, but more that, is there something precious in every moment? And that's a real exploration, because, and that's, I think, really where the edge is. When things are difficult, is life precious? One way, I think, that's connected to preciousness, to life as precious. I like that word. It's not personal. It's not life is great. My life is great, or my life isn't going so well, but life is precious just because it's only this. And I like the last line, your wild and precious life. Because life is precious and wild, and I feel that's one way for me to sort of appreciate it more in this larger sense, is to reflect on it as wild, as nature, you know, like watching a nature documentary or a storm. We have storms inside, but we don't usually see them as storms like we would a thunderstorm. we might feel when there's a thunderstorm. We might feel somewhat threatened if it's coming near our homes. But we don't take it as personally as our inner storms. This is a real edge for me in terms of, fear and anxiety can be very powerful storms, and my interest is growing, and it's so interesting to be right in the midst of that storm, really uncomfortable, really not feeling safe, but still have at least some curiosity. Is there something precious here? Is there something of value here? Is it true that I'm not safe? Is it true that that this is bad? Is a storm dangerous? A thunderstorm dangerous? In one sense, yes, but in one sense, no. Like from the point of view of the earth probably doesn't mind if there's a thunderstorm. what is our life? We have so many ideas about our life, but on a really elemental level, it's these storms and periods of quiet. The sun comes out. And how often are we appreciating it in that way? Like, I don't need another moment than this one. And when we personalize things, it's sort of a deal with the devil. Because on the one hand, we do it because it provides some sense of comfort, some sense of control. It's kind of scary to think that life is a series of storms and without really a center. But it takes away from really being able to see clearly what's happening when we own our emotions. For example, this is my fear. I'm a fearful person. Or even our joys. The people in our lives that we're close to, how often are we really seeing them as a force of nature, not as the person that I know? It's almost like we're owning things that aren't ours, because you can't really control this mind and body. As we, those of us who practice, we all have practiced, we know it's kind of out of our hands. And let alone other people. It's like people who want a lion in their house, like they want to domesticate a lion because they're so beautiful, but it doesn't work. Like the lion doesn't understand that. It doesn't think you own it. It doesn't respond to that. You can believe that you own it, and then maybe you'll get bit. And then we get bit because all the time we're trying to own control. Another way of talking about it is, I think there's, we're very dependent on meaning, personal meaning, and to see life as this precious, uncontrollable, wild unfolding that we're just along for the ride, isn't always so immediately appealing. But the question is it enough, or is it, is there less suffering to, do we have to be someone who's sad, be someone who's afraid, someone who's really happy? Or is it enough to just be happy, to just be sad, to just be afraid, to just think? Is our life precious because of who we are, of our story, of our narrative, of what we hope was going to happen someday? Or is it precious because it is, because it's all that there is? Is, and in that connection, that intimacy with the wildness, pleasure and pain, is there something enlivening no matter what is going on? It's really the connection, in my experience, it's the connection to life that really gives me happiness. Even when I get happiness because I think I did a good job, or I'm being a good person, there's a kind of happiness, but it's always kind of tinged but the happiness that comes from connection with intimacy with the way it is, even if the way it is confusion, is fear, that really I value more than anything else. And it's really an exploration how we do this. I think sometimes we just prompt ourselves to check it out. It's always an exploration. We can hear and we can believe that mindfulness is good and that this moment is good to open to, but it's a skill, and it's always an exploration. It's always kind of a stepping off to just land. And I practice that sometimes in kind of it's like a sneak attack mindfulness, like like just noticing what my mind is doing and how it thinks there's something more important to do than be mindful, or that I can't be mindful while doing whatever I'm doing. I have to plan, I have to think. And then it's just like, I just do it. I think over time, we develop more confidence in just doing it, just seeing what it's like. It can even be, people talk about this, like interrupting your day with mindfulness, because we have to interrupt ourselves a lot of the time. There's just a lot of momentum for mindlessness. And a lot of the times the first thing we notice when we interrupt ourselves is that the reason we were mindless is to keep from feeling what we would otherwise feel if we were mindful. So it's good, I think, to know that mindfulness, although kind of in its usage a lot of the time in our popular culture nowadays. It's like mindfulness, so I'm being with the birds and the trees. But mindfulness is just being with this aching body and this uncomfortable feeling, but really connecting with it. Putting down, what we do put down is being ahead of ourselves. Well, I'm at the end of my notes. No, this is great. I'd misread the timing. So we have about 10 minutes for discussion. Anything that came up for you around this idea of preciousness, how times in your life and your practice, maybe this quality of spiritual urgency of Samvega motivated you to make a change. Or any questions? And please say your name. And I have a handheld mic that we can pass so that it can be recorded and everyone can hear. Thank you. I've actually, for the first time in my life in the last year, I've had a number of kind of chronic, not severe, but annoying and kind of annoying health issues. And I noticed fear around that. And even, you know, maybe it's because it's the kind of first time too. It's like, is this going to be for the rest of my life like this? And just that this body, just realizing how much I take for granted or assume that the body should not have discomfort, have issues. And I think it's a very, it's obviously really deeply conditioned genetically, you know, this as animals, our psychological safety is tied to our physical safety. And we feel that really strongly. So I think it's just an exploration. And I think for me, it's been really useful to, like I mentioned, get intimate with fear itself. What is fear? What is this experience that's so pervasive in our lives to one extent or another, but that we have, most of us probably have so little, experience really getting to know. You know, just like we get to know in meditation, the breath and our body, we can get to know whatever this experience is that's changing, that has physical components that we can be mindful of. You know, right in the, that's what I often do when I'm experiencing fear and anxiety is feel it in the body. It's a lot going on in the body to be aware of how that changes. The attitude is really important. That's really, you know, so it's like it's so quick, the attitude towards fear of being afraid of it, of seeing it as something bad because it's uncomfortable. It's really uncomfortable. It's like the lack of safety, but there's awareness. So if awareness can know that there's fear, then can awareness relax with fear? So I think it's just an exploration. And a lot of the time, it's also learning how to soothe ourselves. We can't open to fear if we are convinced that we're in danger and that we're mortally afraid. So a lot of the time, it's learning skills of soothing the mind with bringing the mind somewhere else, bringing the attention somewhere else, until there's at least some more stability. And compassion also is a way of soothing the mind. Wow, this is intense. I really care about this. I'm going to try to hold this, you know, as if I were holding a scared child. So I think there's a lot of ways, and I think it's really important that we look at it. Thanks for sharing that. Thank you. We have a few more minutes if anyone else has thoughts. Okay. Thanks for sharing that. I think we're about done with our discussion, but the kids are coming in.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.